Okay.
Alright.
All right, let me do my get in character.
1 second vocal test. Right, babe. Right, babe. Right. If you think about it logically, if you think about it motherfucking HGH. Okay, okay, okay. Motherfucking pussy eating time. A lot of motherfucking people have been asking me about this. Rich, how do you eat pussy? How long do you do it for? What fucking position do you get in? And you guys have been bugging me all on my fucking Instagram, all on my YouTube, even on my motherfucking Facebook, which I don't use that much. Just basically asking me how, you know, the bodybuilder way, the 5% way of eating pussy. So, all right, it's basically like this. Now, first step, you got to get down on your knees. This activates closer to the glutes. A lot of people think eating pussy is a core exercise. They're fucking wrong. And no, you know, no disrespect to Jay Cutler, to Kai Greene. Great fucking dudes, monsters of bodybuilding, fucking Mr. Olympias, but they don't know what this exercise activates. So, you're on your fucking knees, you're activating your glutes, and this is where a lot of people get fucked up, okay? I want you to pay attention here. You put the thumb below the clit, not on it, because how the fuck are you going to get your tongue there? Alright, so you got your thumb below the fucking clit, and now you got your tongue on the clit, and this part's important. You gotta concentrate, but squeezing and tightening the muscles. You're thinking about getting bigger, so you're getting bigger. Do you want to just get stronger, or do you want to get fucking bigger? Okay, so now you got your tongue there, you're concentrating, you're activating your fucking glutes. Now you're gonna start saying words onto the clit. And look, I know a lot of people are going to be saying, like, Rich, you're only saying you have to say these words because they're your products. No. If there were products that were more phonetically maximizing of her pleasure when you said them out loud, I'd fucking give them to you. I don't give a fuck. I have enough money. You guys have seen my fucking house. But, all right, so you got your tongue on there. You need to be saying 5150. Kill it. Full as fuck. All day you may. And real food. You just repeat that for as long as you can until she starts trembling. And then you do 5 more sets. This is important, guys. This is how we get bigger and eat pussy. Peace!
It seemed that bit was called Rich Piana Eats Pussy, but it's Chapo, everybody. Episode 36. The only thing that that was missing from that was him taking a slug out of his giant sort of bottle of amino acids in the middle of eating pussy. You gotta, like, you know, take a breath when you come up for air. Just take a slug off your, like, giant water cooler of protein or amino acids. What is that, Felix? What is he constantly drinking in those videos?
He is drinking All Day You May, which is his amino acid product, and you need to do it. Like, you need, it's how you keep getting big. You gotta drink those amino acids.
It's how you keep eating pussy.
It's how you keep eating pussy, and your muscles don't break down when you're activating the glutes in pussy eating position.
Well, you said that, like, his whole thing is you have to fool your body sometimes into getting bigger. Is, like, eating pussy fooling a woman's body into a climax?
You're not fooling her body, you're fooling your body. Like, you gotta confuse the body to lift, to have any progress. So, your body thinks, like, oh, we're about to do sit-ups. No, you're eating pussy and your body's like, whoa, what's going on here? Oh, I better get bigger. And that's how science works.
Okay, we are back. It's episode 36, everybody. I'm Will Meniker. Joining me, as always, Matt Christman.
Hello.
and Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
In a little bit, we are going to be talking to Liza Featherstone, journalist, writer, advice giver, and editor of the new collection from out from Verso, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I got this book, I actually read it just the other day. It's very good. I'm plugging it now on the show. It has contributions from the likes of Laura Flanders, Kathleen Geyer, Francis Fox Piven, Billene Fernandez, many more, but most importantly, our friend Amber Ali Frost. But before we get to that interview, Felix, how has your week been?
It has been, you know what, some people would say that they had a bad week if they had the week that I had, but I would actually say that, lots of failure, but I kind of know what that leads to, guys. A little thing we like to call success.
Hella success.
Yeah, hell yeah, bitch. It's the same thing, really. Just like how love and hate are the same thing, and, you know, paying alimony and raising your kid are kind of the same thing, you know?
No, if ever there is a week to prove our, you know, sort of our theorem and our thesis statement and reason for being, it's this one. Felix got suspended from Twitter again, and holy shit, the grass has been cut, and all I see are motherfucking snakes everywhere.
Yeah, but, like, it's sort of like the B team of snakes. Like, it was just, like, it's, like, I don't know what you would call it, like, if the really expendable expendables.
The most expendable.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, shout out to Virgil Texas. He called them the Suicidal Ideation Squad.
Oh, fuck, that's mean. Nah, but okay, so, I mean, there's one wet guy we can obviously figure was pretty happy about it. There was a certain man, I'd say he's about 60 years old, let's call him Mason, who, you know, I don't know what it is, guys. Every time someone gets mad at me, they don't just forget it. They're mad at me pretty much until the rest of their life, and I don't know why that is. Maybe I have, like, an annoying personality.
Because they got owned, and that's a stain that can never be washed off, is getting owned.
They just, like, yeah, they just, like, really, yeah, just really gets to them. So, a certain guy who said he ran a social experiment by saying, you know, it's a piece of shit, and he's glad I'm banned. And, you know, all you guys proved his point by making fun of him. I hope you know that. You just made me look bad by, you know, saying that he's a bad author and a bad person and threatened to beat up a woman, which, you know, he may or may not have. He may have definitely did. But, you know, you just proved his point about how bad I am.
This was a banner week for proving people's points. As you said, with their own logic, by your logic. I would say better than seeing all of this website's most humorless pussies come out of the woodwork is to see all the genuinely good people who came out to support by your logic and Felix. And shout outs to all of them.
Yeah, I do kind of want to get less ironic for a second. The day I got suspended was, like, it was a bad day before that for me. Like, my stomach was just, like, I woke up and my stomach was shitty because, I don't know, I think, like, I've been having trouble sleeping and stuff, like I always do, and I couldn't really hold down anything but crackers and seltzer, and, yeah, it just, my stomach felt awful, and then I found out that a friend of mine in Minnesota had died, and, you know, then, you know, I got suspended from Twitter, which you do kind of feel silly being mad about that when other things happen. But I, you know, Deadspin, you know, tweeted out in support of me and Rob Delaney and fucking all of you guys have been really great about it. And it's, you know, any one of you guys who have had my back, you're worth 100 of the humorless clods that hate me. So I really want to thank all of you guys for that. It meant a lot to me on a really fucking bad day, and I love you guys.
Everyone loves Felix, and I'm, you know, fingers crossed, there's a good chance he'll be back on the social media website that we all know and love.
We're talking about Ello,
which will lead to some of the funniest, like, huffy, quasi-sarcastic, but actually really angry subtweets of all time. Oh, wow. He's back, huh? Wow, Twitter. Really keeping it together. Really doing something about that harassment problem. Way to go. I'm really feeling safer here on this website now that he's back.
I can't threaten to punch a woman in the mouth in safety anymore without this guy making fun of me. Really a big problem.
In any case, again, thanks to everyone who had nice things to say about Felix. We support all you guys. We love you guys. But what do you say? Should we go into this interview with Liza Featherstone?
Let's do it.
Okay, so I wanted to get to the book in a second, but I want to open with some current news, and I want to read to you from this speech that Hillary gave this week, calling out Donald Trump and his alt-right internet army of supporters. So in this speech, I'm quoting here, she says, "This is a moment of reckoning for every Republican dismayed that the party of Lincoln has become the party of Trump. It's a moment of reckoning for all of us who love our country and believe that America is better than this. 20 years ago, when Bob Dole accepted the Republican nomination, he pointed to the exits and told racists in the party to get out. The week after 9/11, George W. Bush went to a mosque and declared, 'For every Muslims that love America just as much as I do.' In 2008, John McCain told his own supporters that they were wrong about the man he was trying to defeat. Senator McCain made sure they knew Barack Obama is an American citizen and a decent person. We need that kind of leadership."
People forget that part. He said that in response to this woman in the audience wearing sweatpants going, "I don't trust that Barack Obama. He's an Arab." And McCain stops and goes, no, he's a good man. So he was literally opposing a good man with an Arab. That's the context of that awesome statement. That awesome win-ass McCain standing up for decency statement.
"I may not be driving in England, but I'm going to stay away from the alternative right side of the road.
We need less gorilla mindset and more girls with their mindset on success.
We need less Pepe Frog, more girls saying, 'Yas, go off, female dog.'"
Just to cut off the last line of that little section of this speech, she says, "We need that kind of leadership again." So my question to you, Liza, is this the kind of leadership that we need again?
It's so her revisionist of history of the woke Republican Party is amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just like these cheerful little anti-racist, the five times that the Republican Party was not racist in the last 100 years.
As our colleague and friend Christopher Hooks pointed out, when George W. Bush went to Ground Zero and said, "Muslims are all Americans too," that was a great moment. I wonder what happened after that.
Yeah.
There were some...
Shortly before beginning to kill them.
And, you know, send undercovers into their mosques and trap people into cooperating. But hey, you know, mistakes were made. I think, you know, when I'm talking about, like, the least racist moments of the Republican Party, I'm talking about when George W. Bush had push-pulling calls in South Carolina during the 2000 primary and said, "John McCain has an illegitimate black daughter." Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, that was definitely another woke moment.
Isn't that she's black, but that was very not racist. And Mr. Trump, excuse me,
but he allowed George W. Bush allowed Prince Bandar to use the bathroom at his resort.
That's such a good
checkmate.
Point.
Checkmate.
But did George Bush defied sort of heteronormative social standards by kissing King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, and he was like, "My masculinity is not so fragile that I won't kiss my friend
and hold hands."
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Liza, what do you think? And then you guys as well. What do you think of, like, politically or just in any sense? What do you make of Hillary Clinton, like, making this speech and tying Trump to the quote-unquote alt-right and his kind of, like, the Pepe the Frog?
Well, I mean, I'm still having trouble getting past the like the very quick fast forward of Lincoln to Trump. I mean, there's really a lot in between that, those decades, but you know, it's not entirely unreasonable to tie him to the alt-right. He does have a lot of support from actual white supremacists, KKK people. He bears a demagogic similarity to a lot of white supremacists in that he will hold large rallies and denounce specific groups of people in very stereotypical terms. You know, so those things should definitely be criticized, and I don't think it's wrong to of Hillary or anyone else to draw those comparisons. I think it's really an interesting stretch to rhetorically and factually to try to speak as if that's a dramatic break from the whole rest of the Republican Party.
I mean, I guess
That's the really offensive thing about it, is trying to throw the Republicans a lifeline on this.
Say, like, we're the party of wokeness. Like, you know, like we're all about Lincoln and Trump is just some horrible aberration.
It's not like everyone doesn't realize this. The DNC apparently warned her and said, look, we're trying to win down ballot races here against Republicans by tying Trump around their necks, and you're giving them a lifeline. You're totally working against, like, actually winning the goddamn House back in the Senate. But that's because it's not really the project. The project
is to turn
the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, to make it basically a vast, broad party of capital and, like, the middle class, and then basically hold the votes of minorities and any genuine leftists hostage, because they're the only bulwark against this fringe of slathering racists who are going to lynch everybody if they get in power.
Yeah.
And then there's never going to be any pressure for them to enact any kind of genuine progressive agenda.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the strategy. I mean, and that's why, you know, Negroponte and all these other ghouls are also suddenly...
Paul Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz, baby! We got Wolfowitz, son! Yeah, baby!
Guys,
we got the comb licker himself!
Guys, we have a big win. Big win. Principled conservative Klaus Barbie has said that he's with her. All right, so one of my favorite things to do is to look at the Baseball Cranks timeline.
Friend
of the show, the Baseball Crank, you know, unofficial symbol of freedom. Baseball Crank sort of represents this, you know, suburban conservative who is just fed up with Trump's racism. Yet you look at Baseball Crank's actual beliefs and you put him next to that silly cartoon baseball head and he's going, huh? Oh, keep Germany for the Germans. Ooh, I think Black Lives Matter thugs are going to start assassinating whites. And you go, wow, everyone in this party is kind of as racist as Trump. And it's not so much that the Trump begat the alt-right, but rather the alt-right is just a version of the Republican Party that's savvy with memes. Mm. But she's... So, you know, if we're taking the least central... Yeah,
they're basically like the young... They're basically the young Americans for freedom in an age of basement incels.
Yeah, right. And if we take the most cynical view, which I think is
usually
probably correct here, which is that they're trying to transform the Democratic Party, that's one thing. But if let's take the most generous view, that Hillary just really wants to kind of make this broad coalition and run up the score, how many fucking Republicans are there numerically that are going to just go over and be like, well, Mr. Trump, I've had it with your racism? Not that many. It's as we've said, more important to win down ballot races. And most Americans are independent and they vote on issues other than, you know, fucking Rick Cum from the New York Times getting a rude picture of a frog in a Nazi outfit. But this is the media environment and electoral narrative that we have been given, that there is one moral panic this year, and the moral panic is that Jeb Bush could not secure an apology for his wife, and you know, Michael Barbaro feels unsafe.
What? I mean, the smart, like,
political writers who are trying to not fall into this thing of deluding themselves into thinking that she's actually going to get the votes of Republicans who've hated the Clintons basically their entire adult lives. They're saying, well, she's not trying to get their votes. She's actually giving them permission to stay home in November. But, one, how do you know that's going to have any kind of effect versus the obvious effect of undermining the case against Republicans in the Senate and House for their relationship to Trump? And also, you know, I mean, this... That 11th dimensional chess bullshit, where you're like, well, see? And what Republicans are asking permission for Hillary Clinton to do anything? They think she's murdered 50 people in her fucking life.
Yeah, and I can't wait for 2020 when all these pieces of shit that have lined up behind Hillary, everyone who, you know, formed the Freedom Committee to
Project for a New American
Project for a New American Century, Project IMAC Iran, fucking Project Uber for Africa, all these ghouls and neocon creeps and slime balls who lined up behind her. It's going to be funny in 2020 when they stab her all in the back to throw every ounce of support behind Tom Cotton. That is going to be a laugh riot for everybody.
Like a hot rock as soon as Tom's giraffe neck pokes out of the fucking hole.
Yeah.
Well, this is my thing about this speech was that at least 2 points in it, she references Paul Ryan as a kind of as a foil to Trump's supposed awfulness, and he's like, even Paul Ryan called that this was textbook racism, and like, is this what? Where is Paul Ryan on this? And it's like, to me, the Paul Ryans of the world are like a million times more frightening than Donald Trump or the alt right.
Yeah, and they're so much more powerful.
Yeah,
and so many more of them hold state power. I mean, Donald Trump is an anomaly in even being eligible for the presidency. Most people who have his opinions are totally marginal.
And the Ryan budget. I mean, we know what that would do to communities of color in this country if it were ever enacted.
Yeah.
It would be catastrophically terrible for people. But because, you know, it's got fucking graphs and charts, and it isn't, you know, a frog in an SS uniform, it's not racist.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is going to lose, barring any sort of October surprise where they find a video of Bill saying the N-word 58 times in a row, which I guess always a possibility.
No, we're going to find out that Hillary has rickets.
She has rickets, and Bill was flying on the Lolita Express to find a cure. But Trump is going to lose. He's going to probably lose pretty badly in a humiliating fashion. He's going to start up this Pepe Media company that, you know, Chapo will be joining, obviously. The same thing. But there's going to be this core group of sullen, resentful whites that are really behind his message and incited by just insane messages of ISIS knockout gang Latino brigades coming to fuck your wife. But this evil that has existed before Trump is always going to be there. The evil that allows the state to murder black people without any persecution and obliterate social services and price everyone out of fucking cities, especially people of color. That's going to exist, and that is the Paul Ryans, and it's the Rahm Emanuels, and it's everything else. But the existence of this very in-your-face racism, this, you know, crude drawings of any type of minority, allows people to say, well, you know, how can you say Rahm Emanuel is racist when there's a, you know, fucking Keck Hitler 1488 is saying all this?
Now, if we were going to take for granted the proposition that all of this is part and parcel of what has always been Hillary Clinton and the Clintons' political project, which is moving the Democrats to the right and locking down basically all of the people of power and money in this country. If we were to take that proposition, then I have a book here that, in fact, argues that quite well. I'm, of course, referring to False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, edited by Liza Featherstone.
Yeah, well, thanks. I'd also just the Paul Ryan this amazing rhetorical segue for Hillary of making Paul Ryan one of the good Republicans seems like a really big mistake. I mean, if the Democrats have had one thing going for them, it's that a lot of people at the grassroots hate guys like Paul Ryan. They are very conservative. I mean, they are really ideologically conservative. They hate government even more than the centrist neoliberals like Hillary do, and they are hate women and abortion rights and all that stuff. And it just seems like if you were Hillary Clinton, one of the selling points you have is like, not only am I not Trump, but I'm also not Paul Ryan. And once you make him into the good guy, the field of what you're running against is awfully small. I think that's a terrible mistake on her part. But yes, false choices.
Now, your publisher, Verso, was kind enough to send me a copy of the book. And I got to say, it's a great size for a book. You know, it's an excellent trim size. It's got French flaps, which I'm always a big fan of, because if you have those, you don't need a bookmark.
Hey, when abroad got those freaking French flaps, oh, hey, bonjour, hey, my fucking cannoli. Sorry, I'll read that. Too good for a freaking book jacket over here.
Yeah, I want French flaps.
Oh, yeah, she's got the freaking French flaps. Gabagool.
Sorry, I call them freedom flaps.
Sorry, French flaps, trim sizes. I don't know what all these industry terms are.
Spread eagle.
I know the publishing guy over here, but no, I like that too. Also, you don't have to worry about leaving the jacket someplace exactly. Or having it get all beat up.
But you edited this collection, and it's a collection of essays by all women, all feminist writers who are taking on Hillary Clinton, and just basically it's a quick and handy guide to how she has had her, you know, fingerprints over a lot of the worst of our politics, particularly in the 90s, but basically throughout her entire career. And I want to read a couple things from it that I think are a good start. The first I want to read, this is a selection from Catherine Liu's essay about this. She writes, "We cannot understand her presidential race and possible presidency without understanding how she and her husband have been able to consolidate a powerful strain of neoliberal ideology. They have successfully reframed the political project of the Democratic Party as a series of highly rationalized new media and new technology-friendly protocols of personal responsibility, self-improvement, assessment, and failing those, punishment." That is from her selection. And then I want to read, from friend of the show, Amber Ali Frost's essay. She writes, "The presumed lead candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States of America would now be completely unrecognizable as a feminist to many feminists of her generation, the famously radical women of the second wave on which Hillary, consciously or not, built her career. There is no mention of welfare by Hillary diehard supporters because, despite the alleged era of intersectional feminism, civil rights, poverty, and the welfare of children have been effectively cleaved from feminism." I think those are two pretty strong statements, but could you talk about like this shift from the second wave feminism to this kind of the kind of corporate feminism that you describe being embodied by Hillary Clinton and her most ardent supporters?
Yeah. Well, I think I really like that essay by Amber, because I think it is really true that that the second wave was a very radical time. It came in the context of the 60s and of civil rights movement and a lot of people really rethinking gender roles, the family, work, you know, how we were going to organize our society in a profoundly different way. And I think that that certainly the mainstream feminism that we see today, the mainstream feminism that that Hillary Clinton represents, is something much more is something perhaps much more suited to our current era and a product of decades of neoliberalism and left weakness and what it looks like is something more like a feminism for the 1%, you know, in which we are supposed to cheer when a woman becomes head of Facebook or of the United States, and to look away when those same women pursue and support policies that are vastly detrimental to most of the women on Earth.
When I was reading a lot of these essays on that issue, it struck me as there seems to me like there's both a generational divide in this as well as a cultural one, and to me, like, I just kept coming back between this split between people and women in particular who have an ambition to work more and work better and more powerful jobs, and women who have an ambition to actually work less and to have more free time and more, to work, the ambition to work more versus the ambition to work less, which is a real ambition, might say.
Yeah, and I think that, the false choices coven, especially myself, definitely is would be not only represent a much more left and universalist feminism than Hillary Clinton, but we would also, some of us would certainly be firmly in the slacker feminism camp, which is venerably represented by Kathy Weeks and others who argue that there is just too much work in our whole society, and feminism should be premised on giving all of us more time to enjoy our lives.
Isn't that like an artifact of the fact that, you know, second wave feminism was very much focused on getting women in the workplace, but like that was just a byproduct of the larger project of giving women more autonomy in their lives. But over time, That initial impetus sort of fell away, and all that's left is this idea of like working as a good on its own, you know.
Yeah.
Like a woman in the workplace is the point, not a woman in the workplace is a way for women to be more emancipated in their life and have more choices.
Yeah. Well, you know, you could look at the history of feminism as being a little bit like the way that Marx envisioned capitalism, right? I mean, if the patriarchal family is kind of like feudalism, then capitalism does get you out of the house, and it does represent a positive step forward against patriarchy. But then obviously much more needs to be done, because then you are a wage slave, and you need to you need to have a revolution against that situation. So that's pretty much where we're at now.
Well, this gets to this.
And I do think, you know, it's the original in the capitalism versus patriarchy mashup, you have to root for capitalism a little bit historically. But then what you need is another revolution.
Well, there are a lot of reactionaries now that would think, you know, getting women into the workplace is already a bridge too far.
So you have to keep defeating those people.
Yeah. Well, this gets to another, I guess, one of these splits or dichotomies that I came across again and again when reading this book, and that was sort of this split between representation as a concept and redistribution as a political means.
Right.
And it seems that like we're getting the former in lieu of the latter.
Right. And the former in lieu of the latter is definitely not satisfactory. And in fact, I like how a lot of the writers in this book go further than saying that it's not satisfactory, and really argue, as Catherine Liu does, that it's actually pernicious. That the representation itself is doing a kind of work for neoliberalism, where we say, oh great, we have a black president and now we have a woman president, and you know, so these movements, these civil rights movements and feminist movements, have effectively achieved their goals, and even though these victories have occurred in such a profoundly anti-majoritarian context. So I think that that's also really important. I mean, that, you know, a lot of times people will look at this critique of Hillary Clinton and say, so you're just saying she's not good enough. And I say, no, actually a lot of our contributors go further and say that having this particular woman be the first woman president performs a really dangerous ideological work. It's not just not good enough.
It's interesting that you brought up feudalism, because there's a very feudal aspect to this extreme representation view of the world that you, in the representation only view of the world, and I do think, there is, representation is important in media and politics, but this representation only view where you are going, oh wait, is the woman not good enough? A woman did it. A woman did all the bad things a man does, and that's good because, you know, it's very futile, because it's, you're putting all the hopes and dreams of, well, in this case, half of the world, you're putting the hopes and dreams of every woman on earth onto this one uniquely flawed person, and saying that she is above criticism because she is the tribune of all women throughout history. And it's, you can't criticize her because she represents this. Instead of the divine rights of kings, she sort of has the divine right of all women ever, who she has just been assigned their consent. It's through the heavens, and it's very...
Yeah, it's kind of back to the 19th century pedestal.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's also very alone. It's also very futile, because the dang media is trying to burn her at the stake.
Yeah, hell yeah. It's also futile because she has...
And we're participating in that.
Yeah.
It's also futile because she does have the bubonic plague, as only InfoWars has revealed.
It's also futile because so many of her boosters in the media are obsessed with comparing her to a feudal warlord from a fictional television program. I'm talking about a little show called Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Khaleesi who slays. I mean, how much more do you need? They really are comparing her over and over again to a queen, to a divine, a queen who derives her justification for rule from her birthright, and uses a bunch of weapons of mass destruction in the forms of fire-breathing dragons to just assert her will on the world.
That's sort of where we're at, though. I mean, you know, I'm sure that's not what they're intending when they make that comparison.
Yeah, they're giving away a lot there,
but it's obviously it's obviously right out there. I mean, that, you know, she derives her power from her family, right? I mean, from her marriage to her husband. I mean, that's extremely feudal, you know? I mean, and, you know, she's entitled to it. It's her turn. I mean, that too is a very monarchist concept, you know? I mean, and, you know, it's a very interesting set of undemocratic arguments here.
Oh wait, the Grand Empress Maria Theresa isn't good enough?
All right, next on the hit list, number 68, the artist's name is Future, as opposed to his brother Past and his sister Present. Future, the song is called Where Ya At, and it features Drake. No, not Sir Francis Drake, just a guy named Drake. Of course, both of those, they're given names. Where Ya At... And I can guarantee there will be some grammatic failures in this song.
Where your ass was at, dog, with niggas 1 feet. Where your ass was at, dog, with
That's not English. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that's supposed to be saying. That's not even close to English. Do we speak? This is the problem. I thought we were supposed to speak a common language. I thought the purpose of language is to communicate with one another, but apparently when we outlawed nouns, we also outlawed human communication. So here's an entire song, incredibly, that has zero nouns in it, which is an amazing feat. I mean, it's like, if you ever go to Hawaii and you don't speak native Hawaiian, it's a beautiful language, but if you hear people speak native Hawaiian, it sounds like there are no consonants anywhere. This is that, except not.
Where your ass was at, dog, with niggas 1 feet. Where your ass was at, dog, with niggas 10 feet. Where your ass was at, dog, with niggas tried to run off. Where your ass was at, dog, made me put his gun out.
This is the 68th most popular song in America. The actual lyric is, "Where your ass was at, dog, when N-words wasn't feed me." Where your ass was at, dog. I mean, how many grammatic errors is that in one phrase? Where your ass was at. Are they trying to ask, where was your ass? First of all, don't end a phrase in a preposition. Sorry to get anal about this, especially in a line about where your ass is, but where your ass was at, dog. Why is there a dog in the song? I'm completely unaware as to what canines have to do with anything. I guess this is just somebody. Is this song about God? I mean, who is future complaining to here? And it gets. This is really, really bad stuff. I mean, it continues along these lines for a while. It just continues along like this, and then there's a lot of F words and talk about female genitalia and various places where your ass was not at, apparently. Clearly enriching the culture, making America a greater, more solid, moral place every single day. Our popular culture. Big round of applause to all the folks in the music industry for putting out inspirational material like this. This is The Ben Shapiro Show, AM 770 KTTH, KTTH.com.
Liza, I want to ask you a little bit about the reaction to this book when you published it. I was going around, I was looking for reviews of it, and the major review was in the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they ably sort of summarized a lot of what's in the book, but of course at the turn at the end, just quoting from the review here.
It was so weird.
It says, but it's hard to take seriously the gripes of feminists who hold Hillary Clinton accountable for everything the powerful man around her got passed into law. Mm. Husbands are rarely taken to task for their wives' behavior. They're different people, after all. Now, I think that's not giving Hillary nearly enough credit, because a lot of what you lay out in this book is that she was very instrumental in her husband's political career and the policies of the Clinton administration. But even if we were to write that off, it's like the reviewer didn't read the second half of this book, which is about, called Hillary Abroad, and in particular, the journalist Baleen Fernandez's chapter on her role in the coup that just happened in Honduras. So it's like,
yeah,
right, give her credit or don't give her credit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Baleen's chapter and others more than ably document the effect of her tenure as Secretary of State on the planet, and that has nothing to do with her husband. However, we certainly weren't shy about delving into her her time as First Lady, because she was very actively involved in policy under Bill Clinton, and indeed that's like her supporters always tout that time, her time as First Lady of Arkansas and her time as First Lady of the United States, as part of her policy experience. And rightly so. She couldn't have just gone from being a small-time lawyer in Arkansas to several decades later being senator. Like, she did a lot of things in between, and all of those were in a capacity as First Lady. Mm-hmm. It was she was very engaged in policy. But it's interesting how you're supposed to cite that experience when you're praising her, but when you cite that experience critically, then you are being sexist and blaming a woman for her husband's policies, which is an extremely inconsistent argument.
Well, this is what I want to get at. Just the difficulty of critiquing Hillary Clinton from a left feminist perspective. Mm-hmm. Okay, in the introduction to this book, you mentioned by name at least half a dozen people, including Amanda Marcotte, Jessica Valenti, Gloria Steinem, Katha Pollitt. Mm-hmm. You offer their own words, and you offer a critique of their defense of Hillary. Mm-hmm. When you wrote this book, were you, at least in some part of you, hoping to provoke an argument Were you hoping to get some clapback from some of the people you called out?
Yeah, we kind of were, and you know, to be honest, we haven't.
Well,
it has kind of been a resounding silence.
I couldn't even find good 1-star reviews of this on Amazon.com, which is what I was hoping for.
Yeah, no, we didn't. We haven't really got an argument from any of those people. No. You know, and I. I was, you know, we in that introduction, I think we characterized everybody pretty courteously, except people who had written extremely ridiculous things.
Okay, Gloria Steinem has an amazing, you quoted an amazing quote from Gloria Steinem.
We cite Kath Apollett very respectfully, I should say. But
As one should, because we
adore her.
Yeah, not like I know her.
You know, because we just disagree.
Even if you, you know, I don't know her or anything.
But some people just said things that were too ridiculous not to make fun of. So we did. Well, and we've had no pushback.
Sorry, not to leave anyone hanging, but the Steinem thing, you quote from her book, My Life on the Road, where she says, haters condemn her for staying with her husband despite his well-publicized affair. I'm glad Gloria's taking a stand against haters.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
But she says, it turned out...
You know what they say? A woman needs haters like a fish needs a bicycle.
She says, it turned out that many of them had suffered a faithless husband too, but lacked the ability or the will to leave. They wanted Hillary to punish a powerful man in public on their behalf. I reminded them that presidents from Roosevelt to Kennedy had affairs, but the haters identified with those first ladies and assumed they couldn't leave. It was Hillary's very strength and independence that made them blame her. Finally, I resorted to explaining my own reasons for thinking the Clintons might just be, in Shakespeare's phrase, the marriage of true minds. Yet when I brought this up, some Hillary haters became even angrier. The fact that Bill valued Hillary as an equal partner and vice versa seemed to make them more aware that their own marriages were different. So
Bill and Hillary are saposexual.
Yeah. No, she goes really imaginative with that.
But defending Bill as well, when I read this, this certainly must have presaged, we have addressed this on the show before, but to my mind, the most amazing defense of the Clintons so far from Rebecca Schoenkampf at Wonkette, where she said, even if you believe Bill raped someone, all is forgiven.
Yeah, no, that makes everything we cite in our introduction, you know, like tame and rational by comparison. I mean, that was just amazing. It shows the stretches that people have had to make in making feminist arguments for Hillary Clinton.
But it's a huge stretch to avoid responding to you as well, because as we've said, it leaves them with no move. Like, they have no counterattack, really.
Yeah.
And now, of course, I'm going to do the very sexist thing, but do it in a self-aware and postmodern way, of referencing you in relation to your husband. Mm-hmm. But did it annoy you that when Doug's book came out, they all attacked him?
Yeah, no, this is something really interesting. Yes, that annoys me, that feminists have responded to his book because they can criticize him as being sexist because he's a man.
Right.
And then they have nothing to say about our book because we're obviously not sexist and we're feminists. You know, so
you didn't even get like a self-hating female?
No.
We just didn't get this. Is this your own personal version of one of those obituaries of like a woman who is an astrophysicist and they were like, mother, wife, cook?
In fairness, Doug feels really neglected on the other hand because we have gotten all the love from the left.
Okay.
Because the left actually, I can't complain too much about this because the left has really wanted to hear this analysis from women, and so False Choices has been in a constant, like, we have been very well attended to by like all possible left and international media.
You're lucky in your fans. False choices, real hip hop music.
Yeah, exactly. We're like you know, jazz musicians or whatever. But Doug has gotten much more attention from the liberal haters,
right,
who have preferred to ignore us completely.
Okay.
Well, it shows that if you're going to go on a D&D quest to slay the Hildebeest, that you need a female paladin in your group. Or else they'll be able to cast misogyny and drive you away.
Yeah, you also need a gamer necromancer character to challenge the hordes to 1v1. Oh, sorry, guys. I guess we're not here to learn about other people's cultures today. Okay. All
right. But despite all of the criticism of her, which I think is very well laid out in this book about her politics from a left perspective, I think perhaps we're selling her short, or at least it should be acknowledged that many people and many women really do like Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
And feel really passionate about her.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, like, what would you say to women who are, like, how do you make this argument to people who really identify with her? Like, more than politics, because they are of sort of the same generation and are successful professional women who, in Hillary Clinton, see their own struggles and slights by men in a lot of those ways. And when they hear criticism of her, feel that or respond to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I understand that because, I mean, I was a fully conscious adult in the 90s, and she was repeatedly attacked by the most ridiculous conservatives, and who thought her extremely, awful and corporate healthcare plan was socialist, and they thought that she was a libertine lesbian. If only all these things are true, it would be so cool if Hillary were really this crazy libertine socialist lesbian. But in the 90s, there really was this right-wing obsession with her that made her seem as though she must be really cool. And I think it's kind of important to put that in context when people say, like, but Hillary, like, how could you, I mean, Hillary is this and that, wonderful feminist thing. I think that is part of what they're responding to.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of interesting that Hillary's own conservatism and corporatism and neoliberalism sort of proves that they're the sexism against her, because for a lot of these guys, for a lot of the men that criticize her, a lot of the men on sort of the center-right spectrum, you think, well, why are you criticizing? You on the most important issues, you agree.
Yeah.
So much so that the only reason that you would hate her is because she's a woman.
Yeah.
And it is...
I think in the 90s, it was a combination... The hatred of the Clintons was pathological. It was like this weird cultural resentment.
Yeah.
A lot of it was against the 60s. It was against feminism. And then from like the professional politicians, I think a lot of them were just pissed that the Clintons stole all their fucking moves.
Exactly.
I mean, how frustrated must have Republicans been in 96 when Dole was running, and they couldn't put a proposal out that the Clintons wouldn't co-opt. They had nothing to run on because the Clintons were willing to absorb the entirety of the Republican critique of big government liberalism.
Yeah.
That must have been incredibly frustrating.
That's exactly it. They hated them for that. So the Republicans, the Clintons took welfare away from the Republicans, and they took crime away from the Republicans.
It's like they had nothing else.
Yeah. And so by passing this incredibly draconian and conservative legislation on both of those issues, they left the Republicans with no domestic agenda other than hating gays and abortion, which is like, kind of appeal to us.
The centerpiece of Dole's campaign in 96 was 15% across the board tax cut.
Yeah.
Because it was just like a total hail mary. Ah, taxes are bad, right, everybody?
that was the original fight for 15.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, that's not what the current fight for 15 is? Oh, fuck this shit, man.
I have to say that I was in Cleveland for the convention. And I was just walking in front of it and seeing the vendors and seeing the shirts that they had for sale was really enough to give me like a weird sympathy for Hillary. Like Trump that bitch was a really popular shirt. You know, Hillary sucks, Monica swallows, that kind of thing. Like the really like simmering and grotesque misogyny was really on display, and people were like psyched to be able to express it finally.
Well, Chapo Trap House has been very critical of Hillary Clinton. We've made fun of her in the past, but she does not deserve to have Calvin pee on her.
No, hell no.
No, no one does.
Yeah, no one deserves that.
My freaking ex-wife!
I agree.
Yeah, and the concept of alimony. But I think, yeah, there's the Republican psychosis around her is interesting because they often do get precariously close to making a point. Like, Benghazi, I think, is the perfect example. Yeah. For me, there is a scandal in Benghazi, and it was that we were destabilizing this country, and then we were using our embassy to run guns to Al-Qaeda in Syria. And to me, that's like, holy shit! Like, what? But of course, like, Republicans get this big opportunity for this thing that, you know, most people, if they had a better view of that, would go, wow, that's very fucked up. But because they're Republicans, they go, this lying bitch personally killed Ambassador Stevens. She saw Ambassador Stevens at the grocery store, and he asked for more security, and she pretended like she didn't see him because she's a lying bitch. And it's like,
she refused to send the special forces to save everybody because that would have been politically incorrect. I am against the troops.
I'm for Islam.
Basically, you think Hillary has been very lucky in her enemies?
I do. I think that she has been very lucky in her enemies, and that I think that I think she owes her career to misogyny. Actually, I mean I think that Republicans in the 90s helped create a lot of sympathy for her by their endless ridiculous sexism and you know, resentment of her as a professional woman, and they had to have been so excited when they realized that Donald Trump was the nominee, because they had tried so hard to pin some kind of sexism on Bernie Sanders and his supporters,
right?
And there just wasn't very much to be had, But this did not stop her supporters from inventing the Bernie Bro and a thousand like small slights that really put the micro in microaggression were launched.
Spoken like someone who has not listened to the lyrics of Bernie supporter and noted misogynist hip hopper Killer Michael.
Oh, yeah. Killer Michael. Killer Michael. Is anyone going to talk about how Bernard's friend Michael goes to strip clubs and does misogyny?
He does misogyny. Yeah. Yes.
Liza, there's a great line in the prologue by Laura Flanders where she writes, Clinton's numbers rise in lockstep with feminist hackles.
Yes, that's exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, and so Trump is really a great opponent for her because he will continue to be misogynist and disgusting. His supporters will be even more so, and people will be able to get really outraged about them.
Okay,
that makes women want to support.
Hot Trump. Conspiracy theory: not just lucky in her enemies, handpicked her enemies vis-a-vis Donald Trump.
It's a theory.
Yeah, it makes sense.
We do know it has been widely reported, and I don't doubt it that Bill Clinton did encourage Trump to run. As far as handpicked, it seems unlikely that Trump would do anything for other than narcissistic reasons.
That's the thing. So, it's like they might have used the right like neurolinguistic programming to like make it think like, I should be president.
But at that point,
he's only doing it for his own ego. He's not doing it on behalf of anyone else.
Yeah, guys. I think you could create a simulacrum of him if you were like a 1990s sci-fi like author like that. But I just think it's most likely they just got really lucky.
I actually think Will is kind of onto something. Because, okay, what happened during Hillary's plotting on the presidency that has been going on since basically 2004? Larry Craig gets caught in a trumped up bathroom charge. Mark Foley gets caught in a trumped up pedophilia charge. Two of the best conservatives.
I feel like that
Ebenophilia charge. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to, according to market research, 30% of our listeners. But,
because those guys were really presidential.
Yeah, material. Foley and Craig were going to wallop Hillary in the election. Americans loved Larry Craig and Mark Foley. And then the Republicans, still like beaten but not broken, were like, okay, we have this third guy that people love. His name is Dennis Hastert. Another trumped up charge against a conservative. And then they got rid of all the like good conservatives. And then they have to go to Dangerous Donald. And that is, Hillary used the state troopers that swore a blood oath to Bill Clinton, who killed his political enemies, to frame Larry Craig, Mark Foley, and Dennis Hastert so that she would win the presidency.
It's quite a body count.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And can you believe that we have said on this program before that she's a bad politician?
Yeah, holy shit, that's brilliant, actually. She deserves it for that, yeah.
So, Liza, like, going before it, assuming as we are that Hillary Clinton is probably going to be president, how do you see changing this debate or changing the trajectory of mainstream feminism after a Hillary Clinton presidency or during it?
Well, in a way, I'm kind of optimistic. I mean, I think that the sheer awfulness of Hillary Clinton does provide an opportunity for feminism itself to mature politically. I mean, I think that there will be a lot of criticism of her, actually. I think there will be a lot of protest. I mean, and I think the left has done a bit of a better job so far of really laying the groundwork for that than we did under Obama. I think the left was really intimidated to criticize Obama because he was the first black president, and it took quite a long time for people to start getting critical. And I don't think we're gonna have that issue with Hillary. I think that people are already pretty skeptical of her, and I think the Bernie campaign really helped, and we also have a sort of more adeptly critical generation of feminists coming up, I think, that are just really clear that there is no real women's liberation without redistribution. That there is really no feminism without fighting militarism around the globe. You know, that you have to bring all those things together.
So to summarize, false choices. For too long, the feminism game, or at least recently, has been dominated by flashy hip hop style diva feminists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But people are getting sick of it, like Hillary.
People are getting sick of it,
and they want to return to lunch pail, 9-to-5, scrappy materialist feminism.
I don't know, Mike. You know, I gotta put Emma Goldman. You know, I think that you're saying that she was in lunch. You know, she was a 9-to-5 type, meat potatoes type feminist. But if you look at her, she had a lot of similarities in her game to their hip hop style players. Dog. I don't know.
Dog, you got Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you got women of their cloth, immortal feminists, Emma Goldman.
But for their time, they were considered flashy style divas. I don't think you're looking at the whole picture.
No, and now a message from PC Richardson's son. PC Richardson's
daughter. By the way, I only shop at un-PC Richardson's sons. That's where you go in and they say, oh, hi, could I get a TV? And they're like, what, so you can watch the Juron Media, you cuck? By the way, I also think all this discussion of how Hillary's presidency is going to impact feminism is kind of pointless, because we all know that before she takes office, she's going to succumb to her Morgellons. Tim Kaine is going to take the oath of office while playing the harmonica.
Yeah, Tim Kaine is actually Francis the House Cards
from the TV show House of Cards.
He plotted for 20 years to be on the ticket with a woman who's dying so he could become president.
Yeah, he's like blackmailing her doctor, and he's got all of like the top secret reports about the 1500 tumor she has and the and shit like that, the scurvy that's ravaging her. And she's like, he looks in the camera, oh, by stars, looks like this bird's in the catbird seat.
Oh, I say to you, sometimes a woman who has syphilis is more powerful than the greatest general in the army or a jackass with a thumbtack in his hole.
I think this would be a good point to move away from feminism to
forever.
Enough
of that stuff.
Done with it.
We never move away from
it. No. But in addition to being a feminist, a journalist, a writer, you are also, even better than all of those things, an advice columnist, Liza.
That's true. But the advice columnist column is a socialist feminist project, as well as
that
being,
is true.
It being its own thing.
It is also a very gendered job.
That's true. It is a very gendered job.
But you give advice professionally. You have the advice column in the nation called Asking for a Friend. And as long as we have you here, I think we should get some advice.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
So, Liza, I have a first question. I'm asking for a friend. I have this friend who recently was suspended from a popular social media site. I like him. I think he does good stuff, but sometimes maybe he goes too far, and it's cost him. So what advice would you give this friend of mine?
Oh, I mean, shouldn't he just come back under another identity?
Say that this
apparently
friend.
That's not allowed. Apparently that's the crime he committed.
Isn't he already doing that, though? I feel like I'm friends with, like, five of his other identities already.
Say that this friend may have actually gotten suspended this time because this friend, who we mutually know, but he's not in the room, we don't know who he...
We don't know.
He may have been suspended because his display name was Mark Kirk, Press Secretary. And it's turning out that's why he was suspended. If he gets his account back,
that's insane. And you're not.
I know, right?
And that's and you're not allowed to impersonate.
Jesus Christ!
I know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
but fuck that guy.
Fuck this friend. We'll edit this. He's a fake friend. Fuck fake friends. I have another friend. This is another guy.
Okay.
Let's call him Mason Diller. He's a fairly successful novelist, but again, he's on social media and he has a problem where he has this gang of people that wind him up, and I think he takes it too seriously, and in responding to them, he makes himself look bad.
Yeah, he kind of like threatens.
That's a common problem.
Yeah, threatens to kill people's mothers and stuff, and
beat up women,
call the FBI on the trolls.
How would you tell someone to chill out?
He had a guy offer to shoot people in the kneecaps.
On
his behalf.
Well, that's actually,
frankly,
that's how the mafia started. It was a way to sort of get back at the trolls.
Well, this is a common problem. I mean, a lot of people are nuts on social media, I guess the only way that I've dealt with this in my own life is actually off social media. Talk to the person or write them an email, because the last thing a person expects who spends all their time being crazy on Twitter is that you're going to write them an email.
Ooh,
that's violence
and,
to do that.
Yeah, it's really violence. And
sometimes you need to do it, though.
It is, and it's like it can be like a pail of cold water. You write them a long, civil, argued email about why what they're doing is crazy and self-destructive.
Do you think it's good to lead with praise, though, to be like, look,
yeah.
Now, I know you're right, like, these people are terrible, but...
Yeah, it's really... Right.
Your contributions are really important.
We love your novel.
Mason, I love your novel, Coal Country. I'm gonna punch you in the mouth, bitch. That's my favorite novel by Mason.
Your book that answers the question, what if Raylan Givens cried all the time? An inspiration to me.
Now, I say you run into a harasser two times a day, maybe you're the harasser.
That's a good point. Now, okay, enough of these made-up questions. Yeah, because actually, these are bullshit. Okay, I want to give you real people's questions, and what I'm going to do now is I'm going to have you answer Dear Prudy's questions.
Okay.
Dear Prudy, Mallory Ortberg, another... She's an A-list advice columnist.
Yes.
So we're going to steal from her, and I want your... I mean, her replies to these people are she just tells them all to go to therapy, which I think is a little kind of a cop-out.
Yeah, it is.
So, first question. This is a real Dear Prudy question.
Mm-hmm.
Question. My wife wants me chained. I got married 5 years ago, and it has never been a great marriage, but it's been pretty good. I love my wife most of the time. A year ago, I made a very stupid mistake. I got an email from an old girlfriend. We emailed back and forth, then met. We talked over old times, kissed a few times, and decided not to meet again. My wife found out, she got mad and told me to leave. So I did. I apologized, and she took me back under a few conditions. First, I had to let her have all my passwords and agree she could read all my emails. I agreed. She also wanted counseling. I agreed to that too. Then she told me that I'd have to agree to never be out of her sight unless I was at work or she knew where I was. I said no to that, but told her that if she brought it up in counseling and the counselor said it was needed, I'd go with it. I was shocked when the counselor said it was a necessary step to my wife regaining my trust.
What?
But I'd promised. So for the past few months, I've pretty much only been to work. Everywhere else my wife came with me. I'm getting tired of this requirement. I brought it up in counseling this week, and once again the counselor said I need to do this. I asked for how long, and the counselor said, until my wife says she trusts me. I can't live like this anymore. I want to give my wife a choice. Either this condition ends, or the marriage does. Here's the real turn. Other than that, things are going okay. And my wife is talking about starting a family. I always wanted kids, so I'd like that, but not if I can't go to the playground without a child with my child without clearing it with my wife. Do you think there is anything to work with here?
Oh,
well,
my
I would
God.
Want to know. Hold on a minute. We need to know for sure. Is the therapist just like a face drawn on his wife's hand?
Yeah.
How is this a real therapist?
Is the therapist like a crazy promise keeper? Like a Christian, like punitive lunatic. I mean,
obviously, many, many questions
we have
could
so
be
many
asked
questions.
About this.
Yeah,
but just taking everything, assuming that it's all true,
which is a
leap. I have to say,
it is. I mean, here's the thing. My letters don't usually have such an unreliable narrator. I usually pretty much believe what the people are writing to me, and you know, and sometimes people will say, "Are these real?" And in some cases, I actually know the letter writer and can say, "Yes, in fact, that whole situation really is real." And I've never had any reason to doubt them. But I guess this regime that this woman has put this guy under, and with the cooperation of the therapist, is so extreme and weird that I do kind of wonder. Dear Prudy is sort of known somewhat unfairly as an MRA sympathizer.
Wait, Dear Prudy?
I could imagine some MRA is kind of writing into yank her chain. Obviously, if it's real, he should just get the hell out of that situation. He should not start a family with this woman.
He should have kids with this woman.
He should not have kids with this woman. He should get out of there.
This is just
lunacy. However, possibly he is kind of exaggerating. Maybe he needs to, you know, maybe he's continuing to do things that really make her paranoid. Maybe he says things in the therapy session that make the therapist think that, you know, that he's not trustworthy. I don't know. But just based on what he says alone and taking him at face value, he should get the hell out of that situation.
Okay, so look, I respect Liza's viewpoint. Very accomplished and respected feminist. Socials often.
But men are pigs and should be thrown in the basement.
I come from a different perspective. I come from a different world.
Sorry, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I consider myself a pro se civil rights lawyer for fathers. I think fathers are sort of like that's the last civil rights struggle is for fathers, for husbands. Mm-hmm. And this is a clear civil rights case because I think that posting is a right. Every man has a right to post, and this man's wife is denying him his civil rights. So I am announcing I'm filing a lawsuit on his behalf for $600 million against his wife.
See, I don't think that needs to be the. They don't need to involve lawyers. All he has to do is sit his wife down and introduce her to a little concept known as polyamory.
Hell yeah! Hell yeah! This is
She does not seem like a person open to that concept.
Well, it sounds like she's introduced him to the concept of erotic role play and forced chastity.
Yeah, no, I thought that too. That this would be fun if they were doing it on purpose. But it doesn't really sound like he's consented to that. So then there's that issue.
Oh, right. Oh, you can definitely get. You can get
like a dick collar with a padlock.
It's a little cage.
There's a male chastity belt.
Yeah, exactly. A dick cage.
Or a shark cage.
There's a male chastity belt. It's called a fucking wedding band.
Look, you know, all that can be fun, but this poor guy has not agreed to it. He's a prisoner in his own home.
That's why I'm filing my lawsuit.
But maybe he should eroticize it
and look at it that way. Humiliation. Yeah.
And then he would actually enjoy the situation.
Looks like we found a new fetish. Wifedom.
I don't think that's new.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I think we're just asking this guy to reframe his situation.
It's not new, but I think
as voluntary and erotic rather than as oppressive and hellish. And you know, then he'd be much happier.
But you know what? I think that is a good ass answer
to
this advice. That is really good advice.
Yeah. Now, I think we make a good team.
This is I'm moving on now from mining Dear Prudy's advice column to mining a lesser known advice column. That is called Sexy Time. It's in the advice column at The Federalist.
Oh no.
They know fucking over there, though.
Well, no.
They know all the erotic possibilities.
The secret to The Federalist, though, is that they're really horny.
Yeah, so you guys...
That's why they're calling it Sexy Time.
You guys know how DJ Khaled goes, major key alert?
Yeah.
Major key party alert. Wait, what?
No,
allegedly.
By way of context, it says, editor's note, Sexy Time is a feature at The Federalist where resident sex experts Rich Cromwell, the real name,
Rich Cromwell, what was that?
Rich Cromwell and Molly Hemingway. Molly Hemingway.
Oh, what a shock that Molly's involved.
Brendan, please drop Dirk Diggler, You've Got the Touch before this.
And Molly Hemingway, answer reader questions. And this is a question that's very much in sort of in the same vein as the Dear Prudy one. The letter writer writes, how do you avoid getting bored emotionally, intellectually, or physically with someone after being together every day for 5 or 25 years? Love requires diligence, of course. Hamlet's line, assume a virtue if you have it not. Again, we can assume that this letter isn't real and they just wrote it to themselves because the letter writer is writing in the exact same pretentious conservative house style.
Right.
If you quote, I'm surprised you didn't quote Orwell to open this letter about marriage.
To quote Edmund Burke, it's hard to keep it spicy.
But she says, we all know people who have divorced after years or decades of marriage or stayed together miserable due to inertia. Whether they file the papers or not, something good is missing. How might a couple avoid that outcome? Or better question is, what is that good thing that is missing? Now, that's a pretty bland question.
Right. It's a
pretty common question, but I think rather than having us answer it, we should delve into Rich and Molly's answers to
this question. Okay, yeah, I want to know how they answered it.
Okay, Rich Cromwell begins, first, let me say congratulations. The simple fact that you're aware marriage doesn't magically sustain itself puts you on more stable footing than those who think merely saying I do was enough. Pop culture glamorizes happily ever after because showing people arguing over the proper way to hang a roll of toilet paper while kids smash a lamp isn't exactly sexy, rom-coms aside. Rich goes on, so how do you create it, nurture, sustain it? Well, you answered your own question. You study Sir Isaac Newton and his laws of motion, starting with inertia, the one you mentioned.
Hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. You can't talk about Edison, or you can't talk about Newton's laws around me. I'm going to get super horned. This is basically like Spanish Fly for me.
Rich goes on at length about Newton's laws of motion, and I'm going to sort of just read little clips here. He says, are you going to be in motion, or are you going to be at rest? Are you going to let external forces, like work and kids, slow you down? No, you're not. You're always going to choose motion. Newton's second law is a little more confusing. Galileo actually called it first, but he failed to take into account friction. With regard to marriage and the second law, the main takeaway is that you have to avoid unnecessary friction, lest your acceleration decrease no matter how much force you're... What the fuck?
What?
He goes on
what
like this forever.
It also doesn't make sense, because I think any successful sexual relationship is predicated on friction more than anything.
I mean, I thought he was going to go in that direction.
Yeah.
To quote the saying, you don't have friction, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Or you're not.
Dry boys.
Yeah. Dry boys.
Keep it dry.
Dry boys.
To quote the second law of what? Life thermodynamics. A union without friction is doomed to collapse on itself. DMs are open, ladies. Follow these wonderful gals.
Rich goes on about the laws of physics ad nauseum, but like making references to like kids' snotty noses. And then at the very end, he goes, but back to your question. What's good? It's the enemy of perfect. What's perfect? It's the enemy of good.
Oh my god.
Hell yeah.
That's an amazingly unhelpful answer.
So basically that boils down to... Does that boil down to like jerk off in the sink? I mean, what is he...
He closes out by saying... that's what makes memories, what gives us a basis of comparison, and what offers us an opportunity to reflect on our lives when we're almost at the end of our time on Earth and say, no, it wasn't good, but it was great. I don't know what he's saying here.
He's
saying like, jerk off in the sink.
Guys, does this remind you of OJ's suicide letter? Like a little bit? He was like, I didn't have a perfect life, but I want to thank all of you for giving me a really great life. I got to do some really cool things. When I look back on it, I'm really happy about it.
Okay, Rich Cromwell is a fucking bore.
It's amazing. That's an amazing answer.
It's a non-answer. It doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
I think he's... I mean, Cromwell doesn't seem to be fitting, frankly.
No. There is not even one
ounce... I doubt he comes well.
...of practical advice.
No, nothing.
...whatsoever. It was just him... he was jerking off in the sink when he wrote that.
It's all just together for the kids and for the glory of God and all that shit.
That's what it boils down to. He's basically just saying...
That's what they're going to tell everybody.
He's saying something.
No matter what. If that other guy with the lady wouldn't let him leave her sight had written in, he'd say the same thing.
Well, Matt...
Everybody shut... Grit your teeth and stay together.
Matt, you're...
They tell everyone.
You're exactly right, because let's get into Molly's response.
Oh no.
She's the real sex...
Dear married in Michigan, 500 million infants are killed every year.
No, Matt, her first sentence in this response, she's much more practical than Cromwell is.
She says, don't jerk off in the sink, every sperm is sacred.
She's much more practical. She says, simply the fact that you're aware of the risk of divorce puts you on better footing than most young couples. But my advice is to stay as far away from even the concept of divorce as possible. Don't even think about it. Don't consider it an option. Like, even when you kind of loathe your spouse, just get out of that headspace and onto a more productive line of thinking. It sounds so simplistic, but it's easily my best marriage advice. Divorce is not an option.
This is like...
Did the guy even say he was thinking about getting a divorce?
No. He's just saying, like, how to keep things interesting.
Like, she's kind of defying her own advice.
Holy shit!
This poor guy. Even say that he was thinking about getting divorced.
This is why Liza is a professional advice columnist.
Yeah, holy
You're
shit.
You're giving better advice to the advice right, their advice columnists. Than
I feel
even
like they're failing on their own terms.
Yeah, this guy is basically like, sometimes I'm worried about keeping the spark up. And Molly's like, look, look, sometimes you want to jam an ice pick into your spouse's skull.
But don't even think about it.
Then you have to think across the table at his big, stupid, sweaty, egg-shaped head at dinner, and you just want to fucking poison him. But you don't do it.
You don't do it.
And you don't even think about it.
You don't even think about it. Get that out of your head. It's not even good. Don't write about it.
Divorce is the mind killer.
Yeah. You need to refocus your energy to think about the 20 billion fetuses that are killed every afternoon in America.
Guys, this is you haven't read any of this. I'm reading to you now, but you've anticipated Molly's responses perfectly. She says,
she really talks about an ice pick.
Listen to this. She says, all relationships involve you, and you're a disaster. Your spouse will likewise be a disaster, because we're humans. And humans, no matter how much we wish otherwise, are prone to doing bad things and saying bad things and generally being just tremendous disappointments to everyone around us. So practice forgiving.
Mark!
practice forgiving your mark. I mean, spouse. Daily forgiveness is a great way to keep resentments from building. Resentment kills sex, affection, love, and all the other things that make marriages so awesome. At the same time you're forgiving each other, work on remembering that happy marriages can't be focused on your own happiness.
So practice forgiveness.
Whose happiness is it? God's, I guess, right? You want God to be happy.
Well, your kids.
What if there isn't a kid?
Well, that's an
unthinkable.
What
if
there isn't a kid? All right, so, Liza, I've never been married. You have, you're a device columnist. You're married. Do you think it's good to not think about your own happiness during marriage? Or
no, okay. I wouldn't recommend that.
Didn't think so. Yeah.
I think the happiness is a reasonable thing to want. I think that's kind of weird advice. But Will, you were saying.
But to be fair, Molly does close out by saying a mutual focus on each other's happiness is what's missing from bad or failed marriages, which is, you know,
I think you could boil down every Federalist response to all these questions to close your eyes and think of white birth rates.
It's like when you're staring across the table at the sort of globular egg-like head of your baby Huey man-child husband, think of the Weekly Standard and all of the wars we are yet to fight.
But, you know, the letter writer also didn't say that he wasn't happy. He just said he was bored.
Well, he said, how do you avoid boredom?
But that's actually not the same question.
Neither Rich or Molly really addressed the issue of how to keep things. I think it was kind of a sex question.
I think it's kind of a sex question too, but it's not. She made it about divorce, and he didn't say anything about divorce. And she made it about happiness, and he didn't say he wasn't happy. But he did say he was bored, and implied that he's not getting any.
Wait, guys, the Ouija board that I didn't bring up that is on the table right now is conjuring a voice. From beyond.
Oh, what's it saying?
Let me put it towards the mic.
Felix is channeling.
Hello, gents, it's William F. Buckley. You were wondering how to keep the spark on the marriage, but the truth is it's not a spark, but a splash. The way that you keep excitement in the marriage is by going on a sailboat with the sick Harvard boys.
With the National Review.
The National Review, yes. This is why the boat tradition is continued in intellectual conservatism, because just like the line between legality and illegality is blurred at sea, so is the line between matrimony and heterosexuality, my dear boys. That, my friend, is how you keep the spark in a marriage, and that's how Ducky and I were in love until the day that we died. Goodbye, boys.
Bye, Mr. Buckley.
Virtue forever.
Well, that was a very romantic and inspiring apparition.
Guys, we didn't. That's probably our biggest guest ever. Like, no offense.
Yeah, I know. That's amazing. Likely,
no offense.
And then we also conjured from the afterlife.
I know.
Holy shit, guys.
Our powers are only growing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not busting that ghost.
Chapo has definitely become a destination podcast.
For dead people.
For dead people. Beyond the grave.
Actually, Molly does get into some sexy stuff later when someone asks just simply, any recommendations for music to put your lover in the mood? Just trying to expand my repertoire.
Oh, God, I can't wait.
Signed, Running Out of D'Angelo. And, you know, Molly's answer is not bad. She says, it's a scientific fact that Prince gets people in the mood 100% of the time.
Yeah, okay.
She mentions David Bowie cool. and Erykah Badu.
I would have bet that Molly's she would have cool. said Sousa Marches.
Sousa Marches.
Speed.
I think it's a mistake to read everything into the Federalist like they're all just these like unbearable, rigid dorks. I mean, I think the fact is they probably like to party.
Oh, yeah.
They like to party, but they just don't like to talk about it in their advice columns or magazine.
Yeah.
They like to, if you advertise virtue outwardly in your life and project a positive image. This is me responding to the Federalist letter writer.
Yeah, yeah.
My advice to them is if you promote an image of virtue and the nuclear family, what that really does is give you way more cover to sin privately and to have fun because speaking of friction, it creates sort of a taboo. So like, for instance, if you are wife swapping or doing E,
right.
or like going to key parties and stuff, it's wholesome in a way, but it's also naughty.
Yeah, that's sort of what I thought. What is his name? Oliver Cromwell or Rich Cromwell.
Shout out Joel Byrne on Twitter.
I'm pretty sure that Oliver Cromwell had a more zesty sex life than Rich Cromwell.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, how this line has fallen. But I thought that was kind of what he was, maybe the subtext behind his very sort of Cohen-like cryptic answer. It was maybe he was kind of trying to say, you know, just do what you need to do. Don't worry about it. We're conservatives. We do all the stuff behind the scenes.
Yeah. It's
like, you know, I mean, just like, you know, jack off in the sink, visit hookers, like, whatever. We're conservatives.
Mistress. You can have a mistress as
well. Like, Halo.
Yeah. like we're, I mean, that you know, if they were liberals, they would sort of agonize about it and go to therapy or, you know, see a sex therapist or, like, have a key party or whatever. But as conservatives, I think they would just, you know, do the things that men have always done and just, like, not agonize.
Or women,
about it.
Too.
Right. True.
Women can do that as well. So it's just like, when it comes to being a freak, just be Straussian about it.
Right.
There is an exo and esoteric level to sleeping around when you're still married. And if the Federalists kept it real, that's what they would be telling you right now instead of subtly inferring it.
They would, because those are the actual conservative values.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you should keep your marriage together and, you know, you should do what people have always done.
Yeah.
But they just don't have the
Like the Victorian answer to the question of how do I get my wife to give me a blowjob is you don't. You go to one of those the red light district and you have them do it for, you know, 2 pence or whatever.
Right. Yeah, and again, like, you know, if they were liberals and, you know, they would be like, no, you know, you need to, like, give your wife a book or whatever, like, or something, you know, but, like, as conservatives, that would be the solution. It's like yes, there are people that you can employ to do this. The free market can accommodate this.
Or just your friends who are also fellows at the Heritage Foundation or
that's true.
Defense of Democracies.
Boys that you know.
Yeah. Washington is it's a tight-knit community.
Yeah, not making the perfect, the enemy of the good.
And the point is, when you're married, swing for the fences, but the important point is to just keep swinging. Thank you. Yeah. Will Menaker, I write for the Federalist.
Yeah, I think we could write their column better. Yeah.
So, yeah. Fuck it. I'm going to be an advice columnist now. Liza, you have shown us the way.
Okay. Yeah, that's our new career where we will all make, as they've long accused us of, $100,000 outside of our regular profession, which is the podcast.
Keep it real. Liza, thanks so much for talking to us. This was super fun. And hosting us as well.
Oh, it's a delight. Yeah.
We're in another person's Park Slope mansion today.
Leftist luxury, baby. That's our lifestyle.
Yeah.
Cheers, everybody.
Peace.
Bye-bye.
We think it's the banning of free speech. The First Amendment protects material, presumptively.
We don't talk about harassment, sexually brutalizing women in my dream. music, man. We don't do that in my music, man. I'm tired of you saying that.
We got white collar people trying to crap our style, saying we're too nasty and we're too live. Corrupted politicians playing games, bringing us down to boost their fame. They must be joking, thinking we were poor, but they're like flies moving the wall. We stand tall from beginning to end, with help from fans and all our friends. Freedom of speech will never die, for us to have our ancestors died. Don't keep thinking that we will quit, we'll always stand and never sit. We're too live, too black, too strong, doing the right thing and not the wrong. So listen up, y'all, to what we say, we won't be banned in the USA.
Selling records to a totally different audience.